want to begin with the most famous illustration in the most famous book in the history of astronomy. Two copies of this book are included in the exhibition, and one is open at the page with this illustration. Both books are on loan, and I should thank the Royal Astronomical Society and the University of Glasgow for their kindness in lending them. Sadly, we don't have a copy. The book, of course, is the De Revolutionibus, Orbium Codestium, on the revolutions of the heavenly spheres of Nicholas Copernicus, published in 1543. And the illustration presents his challenging proposition that the sun is stationary at the centre of the cosmos, the earth, in the manner of a planet, moves around the sun as the sphere to which it belongs rotates among the nested set of spheres on which the planets are in some way carried. That the earth alone has a companion planet, the moon, moving around it in turn. And in addition to all this, the Earth rotates on an axis of its own once a day. And so the final or outermost sphere of the nest carrying the fixed stars is stationary. Now, searching for something different to say about this most famous diagram, as I came to write this label for the exhibition, I came up with the following. It's a bit self-indulgent to read my labels to you, I know. You're feeling sympathetic towards me this evening, I know, so I can get away with it. I decided to write the following. You know, desperate to think of something that was perhaps novel to say about this. This is surely the most famous book in the history of astronomy, opened at its most famous page, where in a woodcut print, Copernicus boldly places Sol, the sun, at the centre of the cosmos. History does not record the thoughts of the craftsman who cut the block in the Nuremberg print shop of Johannes Petraeus. How much did he grasp of the momentous implications of copying the circles from the orbs that Copernicus had drawn in manuscript, then adding the letters, the lettering in reverse for the central sun and the earth revolving with the moon? Did he mention at home that he had cut out the characters that, contrary to all appearance and received opinion, asserted that the starry heavens did not move? Stellarum fixarum spira immobilis. I spared my readers readers of my label, I mean, my more imaginative thoughts of him sharing a great story with his mates in the tavern. This is a 16th century tavern in Nuremberg. You know, you'll never believe what they made me do today, kind of thing. So, and did he go home and tell his family what he'd been up to? I mean, how did he cope with that extraordinary thing that he had been asked to do? And I don't know that we've spent much time at all thinking about that. To cut these letters, you would think he had a fair measure of literacy. Latin would have been a different matter, but these are only a few words and not difficult to have them explained to you. I ought to qualify the text of my label a bit while holding on to the general conceit. The block cutter may not have been in Petraeus's shop. I don't think we can be sure, but I gather it was common to outsource such specialist work. Further, the cutter would not have been the only person to have had this prior encounter with the Copernican cosmology. It was also usual for a draftsman to draw out the design on the block for the cutter to follow with his knife or chisel. So here are some 16th century illustrations by Jost Ammann of Nuremberg, where you see the designer preparing the block for the cutter to cut it. You realize it? Perhaps I probably didn't realize this fully, but this is a relief process where he cuts away the bits of the block that aren't to be printed, leaving the raised lines and surfaces that are going to appear on the print. The men working the press would not have had time or inclination in their pressured day of fast and very hard work to have concerned themselves with the content of the book. But then there was also editorial work and proofreading to be done. So other people in Petrarch's outfit would have known something of what was going on. In fact, a manuscript copy of De Revolutionibus survives in Krakow. Not the copy used by the printer, so it's not directly related to what happened in Nuremberg. This copy was never in Nuremberg. But still, it's a reminder of the variability of such material, and it's surely closer to Copernicus than the printed copy was, closer to Copernicus's intention. And indeed, it's been treated that way by scholars. And there are a number of important differences, as you see, with the manuscript there on the left. Quite a few changes have been made, somehow or other. Possibly at an editorial stage, possibly by someone called Reticus, whom you'll come across later in my lecture. But you can see that the position of the text has changed from where Copernicus puts it inside, perhaps in the orb, possibly. The printed version sits on the line, on the circle. The Roman numerals have been introduced. The abbreviations in the manuscript have been expanded. The moon orb has been drawn in. That's a very significant difference. Okay, so there you have it. I'm very oblique here, but there's the moon, and the moon is not drawn in the manuscript. So is that the lunar orb, or is that an epicycle, or what is that? But that's not. That's another change that's happened on the way to finished print. I might just look at the print for a little bit longer, and I haven't actually got time, or did I have time in preparing my talk to think too much about this, but it looks as though we'd replay a closer look. As you look at it, I mean, I know it's very familiar, but it definitely is a careful and very ambitious piece of work. I mean, if you think that this is a woodcut, and there may be people in fact, there are certainly people in the audience who know more about this process than I, but if you look at how these characters have been treated with these long tails and so on, cutting through the line of the circle, and that doesn't, I'm not quite sure how that was done, but it wouldn't be easy in a woodcut. You can do a lot of special things with woodcut, it's very true, and you get skilled at it. You know, we're talking about the city where Dürer was working and so on, but nonetheless, that looks to me like we could be a lot more thoughtful about looking at this print very closely and thinking about how it was done. And at the very least, one would want to say that it's a fine piece of work, and some trouble has been gone to make it look as good. And we take that elegance for granted, but in fact, a lot of thought, and I think a lot of skilled work has gone into making that happen. And I think that's in line with what we know about Petraeus wanted this book. He asked Reticus to let him have it for printing and so on. It wasn't a matter of Reticus, perhaps you don't know the story, but you will as I give my lecture, but of Reticus coming back and needing to look for a printer. That was all set up before he got back to Nuremberg with the manuscript. So surely there was an ambition then in the printing shop for making a quality publication, and that woodcut, I think, seems to bear that out. Now, that label that I self-indulgently began with is an example of where I wanted to place the emphasis of the exhibition, as Stephen has explained a bit. Closing now within a week, the Renaissance in Astronomy, Books, Globes, and Instruments of the 16th Century does nothing more profound than offer a different perspective on how astronomical activity was carried on in the 16th century. Alternative from the usual one, where cosmology, and in particular planetary theory and configuration of the planets, the dynamic arrangement of what we have come to call the solar system, and in particular the position of the Earth, that has all been the big story, almost the only story worth telling. Of course, it's a great story, but this emphasis does not reflect the profile of interests of people who lived in the 16th century. As Stephen, in fact, pointed out in our study afternoon a week ago on Saturday, a common name for the study of astronomy at the time was simply the sphere. And the sphere was variously and almost interchangeably the celestial sphere of the heavens themselves, as supposedly represented on the left, the instrument in the middle known as the armillary sphere, and the standard book by Sacro Bosco, De Sphaera, or Sphaera Mundi, that explained the discipline known as the sphere. You could talk about all of those things as the sphere. On the celestial sphere, as is in the sphere in the sky, was the pattern of the stars organized and recognized through the additions of the astronomers, the constellations, the equator, the tropics, and the ecliptic, that is the path that the sun traces annually through the zodiacal constellations. Now, the planets did not form part of the study of the sphere. I haven't mentioned any planets, have I? Except for the sun, because the sun is a planet in the Ptolemaic system, but a very special and important planet, and that's the only planet that figures in the study of the sphere. For the purposes of time-telling, calendar regulation, position on Earth, the appearance of the sky as it changed according to time, date, and location, and for much of the astronomical content of astrology, the sphere fell within a larger and more detailed discipline that dealt with the relationship between the heavens and the earth, a discipline known as cosmography. Not a term we're familiar with now, but a very common term in the 16th century. For none of those technical matters, the business of cosmography, for none of those matters were the planets especially significant. Now, cosmography became an enormously successful enterprise. We might say a global, European business in the 16th century. The additions of Ptolemy's cosmography and the variety and originality of their content, outstripping by many times the additions of his Almagest, whose reception and influence have turned the heads of the historians of astronomy. Cosmographia, by the way, was the common 16th century title for the book we are more likely to call Ptolemy's Geography. Now, I've talked about all this before, maybe some of you have heard me talk about this before, and it's treated in the exhibition, so I shouldn't go on too much here about the role and popularity of cosmography. But it is important to have this in place for what I want to say about things. Remember, the title is Thoughts and Things. Because once we admit cosmography into our characterization of 16th century astronomy, it isn't long before we start to notice the importance of things in how this expanded discipline of astronomy is practiced, how its practitioners and its consumers set about promoting it and becoming engaged with it. Much of the materiality of astronomical practice remains invisible if we confine our attention to planetary theory. If, however, we admit the practitioners we have included in the exhibition, astronomers omitted from the traditional Hall of Fame, but with very significant reputations in their time, we find them active in making instruments and globes, in printing, in establishing workshops and printing houses. Johann Stoeffler, Johann Schoener, Peter Appian, Gemma Frisius, Gerard Mercator, and others fall into this pattern of work. It's very striking how many of the prominent cosmographical astronomers think that it's important to forward their discipline by becoming engaged in printing, directly engaged in printing and making. The model for such a career was set by an astronomer lying just outside the date limits for the exhibition, which perhaps meant it was badly chosen. But Johannes Regiomontanus, the leading astronomer of his day, who established one of the early print shops, of any type of print shop, in Nuremberg, who made instruments in brass and whose books contained printed paper instruments. So I've given you a list of pretty, if you like, big beasts in terms of astronomical reputation of the time. I just show a nice picture of Nuremberg, by the way, which is in the exhibition, because it's on the leaf of a diptych sundial. We only have one leaf of this sundial, but it's beautifully engraved with a representation of Nuremberg, where much of the action I'm talking about is going to take place. As I say, these are pretty people I've mentioned are important in terms of astronomical reputation in the 16th century, even if they're usually accorded only incidental, with the exception of Copernicus, or of Regimentanus, of course, or even negative roles in the story of planetary theory. The negative one I'm thinking about would be Appian. Other less well-known figures in the exhibition who conform to that pattern, that career pattern, would be Georg Hartmann in Nuremberg and Miniato Pitti in Florence, you know, cosmographers with that range of activities. One of the first books in the exhibition is Johann Stoeffler's Visitatio Fabrica Ususque Astrolabii, published at Oppenheim in 1513, its first edition on the right. As well as an astronomer and cosmographer, Stoeffler was a maker of instruments and globes. This book was his most influential work, an account of the astrolabe, but organized not around geometrical projection as a theoretical construction, but around making and using the instrument. If you open this instrument, you find the first of this book, as a Freudian slip, this book, the first half of it, it tells you how to make an astrolabe, and the second half tells you what to do with it once you've got it. It's very engaged with making. It doesn't ever, anywhere that I've ever seen, tell you what an astrolabe is. It is what it is, what you make and how you use it. And the book itself is also a kind of instrument. These are two of the folio sheets. How can Stoeffler, you might think, allow himself a page such as this, with this one woodcut, just this single scale? That's how it works. He sets out each scale. Each scale is given in its totality, as though it were an instrument. And as you go through it, you realize that perhaps it actually is an instrument. Maybe you're supposed to use this scale. Perhaps you measure things off it, and so on. Indeed, you're told to do that kind of thing in the book. And in this case, as you're constructing it, this is a sort of, you're wondering what this piece of paper is I've allowed to fall on the page before the photograph is taken. Not at all. This is a little flap which folds up here. You fold it out so as to get the center, which is way off the page, of the arc that you're drawing in constructing the instrument. So the center isn't on the page. You can't have a book big enough to have the centers of all these arcs you have to draw. So you have these little extensions that fold out. So you really do have to work at doing this. In fact, I think the next slide. Yes, the next slide is another of these with two fold-out little slips. And following that, you have it folded out like this at the bottom. So you see how far he has gone in locating for the user the centers and intersections and so on that you need in following the construction that he's telling you to follow in making your astrolabe. Now, these are not illustrations, I don't think, of instruments in the sense we understand. They sort of are instruments, or they become instruments, and you're told in this tradition of using a book to make measurements across and use your rule and threads and so on. You're actually engaged with the book. It isn't really in the way we would think of as an instrument of something, I mean, an illustration of something else. So I want to use Stoeffler to answer a question that might arise about the agenda of the exhibition. If the intention is to give more emphasis to things than is usual, to shift the balance more towards things than thoughts, or at least to bring things more into play, you might ask, how can I claim that when books are so evident in the exhibition, those of you who have seen it? Full of books, well, half the objects are books. Of course, books are manufactured objects. That's an obvious fact, but you might think a trivial one, because we think of books mainly as vehicles for ideas and arguments. But look at this book. its manufactured qualities are not unlike those of the instrument, and the way you engage with it, the way you're meant to use it, is not unlike, not at all unlike an instrument. So is it appropriate for the 16th century to characterize instruments as things and books as surrogate thoughts? And it's not just the pages with additional flaps and foldouts. The book takes you through the construction of the astrolabe, as I said at the start of it, when I introduced this book, takes you through the construction of the astrolabe, and each scale is presented to you fully realized on paper. It's not really an illustration of something else. You can use it as a scale. This is a very active sort of book. Indeed, one of the copies of a Stoeffler in the exhibition, in one of the copies, there's a printed instrument that you're meant to cut out and assemble in this Mainz edition of 1535. You have a complete astrolabe. And I'm sure lots of them had complete astrolabes, and of course most ordinary human beings wouldn't be able to resist cutting it out and making their astrolabe. But for somehow this one has very, very fortunately survived. Remember that the printed book is a fairly recent invention at this point. It's not clear where it's going to go and how it's going to be used. Printing is certainly opening up different kinds of instruments alongside different kinds of books. Here is perhaps the most famous set of gores in the history of the globe. Gores are these pointed sections of curved, curved triangles with curved sides, perhaps you could say, sets of printed sheets that you cut out and paste around your sphere to make a globe. And this is perhaps the most famous set of gores in the history of the globe. Famous because it's the first, well, for a number of reasons, but for one thing, it's the first mention of America on the right there. Which appears, by the way, at the same time on a large map by the man who made these, Martin Walsimuller. And on these gores that can be wrapped around the globe, which would be the earliest printed globe, except that no assembled globe is known, we have only a few sets of the gores. Now, it's easily, these are very, very famous, of course, you see them in every globe book you and so on. It's easily forgotten that these gores, as well as the larger map, were printed to accompany a book of 1507, the Cosmographia Introductio of Walsimuller and Ringmann. They're part of how that book is meant to work. They come along with it, and they work with it in the same way as Stoeffler's astrolabe, that paper astrolabe does. The idea of printed sheets that could be wrapped into shapes to form instruments, like the globe, appears also in the work of the Nuremberg astronomer, mathematician, and printer and instrument maker Georg Hartmann. These are fabulously rare, but nonetheless, you see two examples here of something that you can turn into a diptych dial with proper set on the proper sort of substrate, and even one that you can apply to the shape of a crucifix to form a crucifix dial. That's a sundial. And in the exhibition, there's another fabulously rare thing, an assembled paper astrolabe by Hartmann. So that's the front, assembled, and the back, and in the Rigi, or star map, on its own. We have to remember that while brass instruments are very old, we have an astrolabe in the museum that by this period is over 600 years old. And even if we confine ourselves to brass, European brass instruments, they go back 400 years at this point. Printed instruments are a new invention here. You might say, well, the book isn't going to pursue this direction. It isn't going to become more of an instrument. Well, in the field of cosmography, actually, it is. In fact, one of the most popular books of the 16th century is the Cosmographia of Petrus Appianus, and it will have paper instruments on its pages. And it's a very popular and common book. It has both vol vells with moving parts and scales to read off values using a thread or a rule. Peter Appian is another of these astronomical craftsmen, a printer, globe maker, instrument maker, cosmographer, and astronomer. The first edition of his Cosmographia, with three instruments with moving parts, appears in 1524, so just a decade or so after Stoeffler's first edition of his book on the astronomy. There's a copy of a later edition in the exhibition. But before saying much about Appian, I want to go back to the printed globe and talk about the introduction of printed celestial globes by this man, Johann Schoner. Schoner is another astronomer, cosmographer, printer, and maker, a scholar of great respect and standing in the 16th century. Like Appian, he produced a book with moving instruments, first while he's working in Bamberg. This is his Equatorium Astronomicum of 1521. In 1526, he's moved to Nuremberg. He has a printing press and a workshop in Nuremberg, where he becomes a friend of Georg Hartmann, the chap who made those paper instruments we saw in the paper astronomy. And he's also, by the way, a friend of Albrecht Dürer. He has already been producing globes in Bamberg, and it's he who invents this idea of the pair of globes, a terrestrial and a celestial of the same size. And that's appropriate to the project of cosmography, where the heavens and the earth are to be studied together and in relation to each other. So that was the idea of those two, that pair of globes, which is a common feature, of course, of globes for centuries. And it starts with Schoner. The globe that you can see, the coloured globe in the exhibition, is on loan, on long-term loan now from the Royal Astronomical Society. It's the earliest, I've been saying this to any of you who've come round with me on one of the tours, it's the earliest printed celestial globe to survive. There is another copy. And it's wonderful that we have it now in the collection here. It dates from around 1533. Well, the woodcut gores, and they were printed by the woodcut was made by 1533. And in the same year, Schoner publishes this handbook to go with his globe, because these are things that people are unfamiliar with. You don't know what to do with a celestial globe when you've got it. So you need a book, you know, to tell you what to do. And Schoner writes the book, and you can see how close the illustration of the globe in his handbook and the globe itself are. I'm not supposed to be talking about planetary theory, but in the context of Schoner's standing, it's hard to avoid mentioning that Schoner played a vital role in the appearance of De Revolutionis, encouraging, as Hartmann did, Georg Reticus to visit Copernicus in Frauenberg to see what could be done about encouraging him to publish. And being the addressee, so to speak, of the Narratio Prima of 1540, the first account, an outline account of the Copernican system, written by Reticus and published by Reticus as an open letter to Schoner. See the first edition, where you can see that it begins by addressing Johann Schoner, the man who made that globe. So he's really in there. He's really part of so much of what's happening in 16th century astronomy. I have to admit, planetary theory included. And when Reticus brings the precious manuscript back to Nuremberg, it is Schoner who receives him before it is printed by Schoner's associate, Petraeus. In a letter to Reticus, Petraeus compliments him on the good opinion held about him by Schoner, the most distinguished man of our city. Now, since the city was Nuremberg, that was saying something. After Reticus's visit to Schoner, Reticus is sort of on sabbatical, if you like, so to speak, from his mathematics chair at the University of Wittenberg. And he's on a series of visits to distinguished astronomers. He then goes on to call on Peter Appian in Ingolstadt. And it was on Appian's own printing press, so he's already introduced Appian as one of these scholar printers, on his own printing press that he produces one of the most outstanding books in the exhibition, the Astronomicum Caesareum of 1540. the ultimate instrument book in this tradition of the scholar printer. Now, I said the outstanding book in the exhibition, it of course gets ignored in the Copernican story because it's published in 1540 and is utterly, thoroughly without any apology or repentance, Ptolemaic. You can see the epicycles and the deferent circles of the Ptolemaic theories are made into paper in this, and each opening, well, at least the set of openings which are what are called equatoria for the planets, each opening has a separate paper instrument to deal with. From the first place, the planetary longitude, so the longitude of each planet is there in an instrument rather like this, and also then a separate diagram, the planetary latitude, and each diagram is different as you open the book. So that's just so un-Copernican. I mean, Copernicus wanted to bring everything together. He hated this separation in separate instruments, as though it wasn't the cosmos, as though things weren't bound together. And Kepler, for instance, one of the most convinced Copernicans of the next generation, is very, very sniffy about this book in the New Astronomy. He says how ridiculous it is. Anyway, if you look at it, it's not ridiculous as the outcome of a print shop. I've got another couple of illustrations. On the left hand side, you have the latitude, a diagram for the latitude of Venus for the work out the position, the complementary coordinate of Venus, not the longitude but the latitude. And the marvelous diagram on the right is one for calculating the occurrence of eclipses. These are very, very complicated Fauvels. Owen Gingerich says that the planetary longitude of Mercury is a particularly tricky one, has 9 visible disks. These things turn around, you turn them around. So how are you going to turn them around? Well, there has to be a sort of paper mechanism underneath to allow that to happen. It can't just be threaded in, because that won't work. So there has to be sort of disks and flange arrangements underneath to make all of this possible as a piece of paper engineering. And Gingrich says that there are 9 visible disks for the planetary longitude of Mercury, and 9 further disks underneath to make it all happen, invisible ones to make it all happen. So they're all tremendously complicated. And that's all happening in Appian's print shop. We can offer 2 historical links from the activity we've been thinking about happening for the most part in southern Germany to a new centre of craft astronomy in the Flemish university town of Leuven. And the figure there of Gemifrisius, a professor of medicine, but active in all the core disciplines of cosmography, globe making, and instrument making, and managing a workshop. One of these links is through Appian, and the other through Schirmer. Gemma prepared a revised edition of Appian's Cosmographia, and it was printed in Antwerp in 1529 by Roland Bollert. It was Gemma's version then, Gemma's edition, particularly after he produced an expanded edition in 1533, printed again by Bollert, that became the success story of the Cosmographia, this very popular book that I mentioned through the 16th century. There are close to 50 editions in the 16th century. Gemma added another Pierre Volvel, so he too was involved with paper. And so these Pierre Volvels, even in his popular book, can be very complicated. This one, the one on the right, for instance, is particularly tricky to make and even to use. It's worth noting that this fashion for paper instruments fed back into editions of Sacrobosco Sphere, which then begin to appear with moving Volvels as well. So this becomes a very popular thing to have. Gemma also became interested in this is other illustrations from the Gemma edition of the Cosmographia of Appianus, which I don't have time to really try to explain. And this is Gemma. He also becomes interested in that particular form of paper instrument, the printed globe, and he was encouraged by Bollert, who sold Schirmer's globes, a sort of agent for Schirmer, in Northern Europe, but he couldn't get enough of them to satisfy the demand. He wanted to have a source of globes much closer to home, and Gemma employed the goldsmith, Gaspar van der Heijden, to engrave in his workshop. Gemma always maintained a respect for Schoner's published work on the globes, by the way, which is obvious in his writings. Anyway, the involvement of a goldsmith now in the production of printed globes led to the fundamental shift in the craft context for globe making from woodcut to copperplate engraving, with its much greater scope for fine, detailed work. So this is Gemma, or Gemma, perhaps I should be saying, but you'll forgive me if I don't. And here, see how he presents himself. He's holding the globe. He really wants to say, look, this is what I do, you know, my chaps, for the most part, make these things. And you see, he surrounds himself with the tools of the trade. This is all very carefully placed, of course. He wants to say that here he is with all these things. And he also has other instruments. You'll see both of these instruments, this astrolabe and this arm. Of course, he's a learned man, you know, he has lots of books and so on. But nonetheless, you see very clearly how he wants to present himself. And this is one of his celestial globes, the only one I've seen in Britain, in the collection in Greenwich. And you can see the printed signature here, which mentions the people he worked with in making the globe. And of course, here are two instruments from the Louvain workshop in the exhibition. Both signed by Gemma's nephew, signed himself as Gemma's nephew, Nepos, the astrolabe, a man called Arsenius, the astrolabe on the left, and this equatorial sundial, or astronomer's rings, really, is where Gemma sees it on the right. So both of these instruments in the collection here have come from the workshop in Louvain. And of course, Gerard Mercator, perhaps our last and greatest example of the craft cosmographer, learned his trade in the Louvain workshop, collaborating with Gemma and van der Heijden. Mercator was the master engraver in copper and brass, producing the most important pair of globes in the 16th century. See the only UK examples in the exhibition. Sorry, I have to keep doing this, but it really is a lot of nice things in there you want to see. It shuts down for good. Making large, fine astrolabes. Actually, not in the exhibition, I'm afraid, but there are two in there, very much in the Louvain style. And of course, the century's most celebrated cartographer and cosmographer, and a reader of Copernicus, again, see the exhibition with the first edition Mercator's own copy of the first edition of De Revolutionibus. But as time is moving on, I want to get to England before time runs out. England is interesting, for one thing, because the history of early printing is a bit like the German story, with significant roles being played by cartographers and instrument makers. For example, the first copper plates used to illustrate a book published in England were prepared by an instrument maker. The first Englishman, that is to say, not a Flemish immigrant, to engrave a map was an instrument maker. The Elizabethan instrument makers for whom signed instruments survive all also engraved maps. So they're really into the business of the early history of printing in England. Again, I have two historical connections, this time connections between Louvain and the beginnings of a tradition of this sort in England. One is through John Dee, who visits Gemma and Mercator in Louvain in the early 1550s, acquiring globes and instruments which he brings to England. And a Louvain-trained maker, Thomas Gemini, no doubt well known to Mercator and Gemma and van der Heijden, is this Flemish guy from Louvain who sets up the first commercial instrument-making shop in England in the 1540s. There are definite traces of craft practice of astronomy, my subject, in 16th century England, and it helps to shape the overall character of the discipline, but we do not find outstanding representatives of the likes of Schoner or Appian or Mercator. Perhaps London is too compartmentalised into all its separate trades, but then you might have said that about Nuremberg in the early century. Perhaps it's more that London comes late to practical mathematics generally, and that a fully embedded craft practice of leading astronomers has run its course by then, and there are other intellectual priorities and issues. I mean, you can think of one or two characters like John Blagrave, I suppose, or Thomas Hood. Hood wrote on globes and other instruments. He tries his hand at engraving for printing and so on. But I can't offer any big beasts, is what I'm saying, once we move over to look at what's happening in London in this tradition. But established assumptions about the nature of the discipline do inform its introduction into England. In the first English textbook on astronomy, Robert Record's Castle of Knowledge of 1556, in the exhibition, the master tells the scholar in detail how to make a celestial globe. Tells him what to do, how to set about making this thing. And he really means make it. I mean, here he explains how to turn the globe ball on a sphere. Okay, yeah. Tells him how to actually make the sphere. And you might note the remark on the bottom left of this, where he says, "I leave it to the studious device, let's say, of your own practice, for such things are better taught by hand than by mouth." So he really means it. He's not messing around. He's not he intends this to happen. And here he goes through the making of the stand. You see, and these, by the way, are the two sort of upright semicircles that hold the horizon ring of a globe. So even the sort of carpentry and so on, he gets down to that level of explanation. And he does this for both the solid celestial globe that we've seen, like shown as one, and the armillary sphere. He goes through both of them. So the scholar needs both of these. He could jolly well have to make them for himself. Well, he could go and buy one from Gemini, presumably can't. And it's nice at the end of the second treatise is divided into Record has gone through the making of the spheres. He doesn't then include the usual didactic summary of the important points as he does elsewhere. And so what he says is, a bit bigger, here needeth no repetition, which you'd normally expect at the end of the individual book, so to speak, or treatise, because all standeth in working of the former lessons before repeated, and therefore this second treatise shall end here. See, there's no point in going over all the points. I mean, you really meant to make it. What you'd have to do is make another one. So there's no point in rehearsing it, because that's not what this book is like. This bit of it, anyway, it isn't meant to be a rehearsal. It's the doing of it that is the point. So, okay. Thomas Gemini, from Louvain, made a very significant impression on 16th century London. This is the astrolabe by Gemini, which is in the exhibition. To one instrument, by the way, just of course, just showing different configurations. Here, fully assembled, typical Louvain astrolabe. And here, with all these plates taken away, so you see the inside of the mater. And what you find is what's called a nautical quadrant, which is exactly the way Gemma presents it in his Cosmographia. And indeed, just the same as you'd find in the Arsenius astrolabe there, and the same as you'd find in the Mercator astrolabes. So it's very much in this Louvain tradition. So, Gemini is important. Inter alia, he prints Leonard Biggs's prognostication of right good effect in 1555. In the preface, Biggs announced that he's pleased with his association with Gemini, referring to his plans for publication. I'll just cut this out for you. He says, "As the goodwill of printers not had, by not having the goodwill of printers," it's put a bit awkwardly, you might think, "as the goodwill of printers not had, hath kept the aforesaid from you, these books I want to print, so I trust the willing mind and excellency of Thomas Gemini shall bring them shortly unto you. So that's quite nice. He's not like a recruit of Gemini into his plans. One of the promised books, Tectonicon, was published by Gemini and printed by John Day in 1556, and then simply printed by Gemini in 1562. These two editions are associated with Gemini. And on both title pages, the 1562 one here, Gemini doesn't miss the opportunity to say that he's dwelling within Blackfriar and they're ready to make all the instruments appertaining to this book. In fact, it's a very sort of very much in the tradition that I've been talking about tonight, that in one of the additions that Gemini makes to the 1556 edition is this quadrant, and you'll see that it says down the bottom, if I can read it, if ye list not to make a quadrant, ye may use this very well. So you can use this one on the page. Right. You don't need to go and get one. Adding a plummet and line with sights or otherwise. So you meant to somehow use the book to be a quadrant. It's quite nice. That's very much in that tradition. This is published in London now, that's included. Diggs tends to use Thomas Marsh as his printer after the 1562 edition, which is in line with Gemini's will being dated to May 1562. For the sake of symmetry, at least, I want to end with another striking cosmological woodcut, that accompanying Thomas Diggs's perfect description of the celestial orbs of 1576. Accompanying yet another vision of his dad Leonard's prognostication. Clearly based on Copernicus, as is the whole of the perfect description, based on Book 1 of De Revolutionibus, but with a radical addition, famously, of course, as you can see again, of the orb of stars, not now just fixed, as he says, but, as he says, infinitely up extendeth itself in altitude spherically, and therefore immovable. So no room for doubt here. He's making clear what he's saying, that this is an infinite universe of stars. You remember, of course, previously confined to the planisphere. If I try to run my conceit of the block cutter, and perhaps others involved in the production telling his friends and family about his day, this is going to be an even taller tale for the supper table or the tavern. He can hardly have failed to notice what he was obliged to do, to send these stars off into what? We can't really say into space at this stage. In fact, reading Diggs' text, the stars seem to invade heaven itself, the habitation of the elect. It's as though the stars are going into heaven. That's what Diggs says in that text. Not quite space. And there are quite a number of editions of this. I haven't looked yet to see whether there are any changes in the block. But in fact, to be honest, it's very hard to find originals of this cut because I know people stole them, I suppose, and they're generally missing, which is a great shame. But for one thing, it certainly is a fine and I would have thought valuable woodcut. And the art still wasn't very developed in England at the time, so this is rather a special thing and will repay some study, I'm sure. Thomas Marsh, again, was the printer of the first edition, and we can't, as usual, say anything with certainty at all about the block cutter. One name of a very able cutter or designer who was active in the 1570s, for the right time, was John Betts. In William Cunningham's Cosmographical Glass of 1559, a book well known in our sort of world, was printed by John Day, who, as we saw, had some association with Leonard Diggs and with Thomas Gemini. And the famous border for the title page is signed by Betts, as are other cuts inside. I've read that up for you from down here. It says IB, fake it, so we know who cut this. And this border, by the way, is used again in the D. Billingsley Euclid. So it was a valuable thing. Perhaps a bit closer to the target is the fact that A.M. Hine, the great authority on printed illustration at this period, suggests that among Gemini's additions to the 1556 edition of Diggs's prognostication, the one where the reader was invited to use that printed quadrant in the book, one of the additions was this the design of this zodiac man, which Hine attributes to Gemini. And he points out that the cutter has signed the block, CI, down there, using a knife. So there are little clues about people, these people, and their chums in the tavern. But no, I'm afraid we don't get to a denouement, if you're expecting it. That's right. There's lots more we can try to do, but I hope I have at least introduced you to the interest of a craft perspective on the history of astronomy in this period, and perhaps convinced you that, at least in places such as Nuremberg and Louvain, if not later in London, workshops and printing shops were valued as sites of astronomical practice. Thank you.